Hello and welcome to a brand new rebooted Monocle Arts Review. We've taken our daily cultural digest, we've squeezed it, we've stretched it, we've given it a fresh lick of paint, we've given it a few more voices and a bit more space to explore what's going on in arts around the world and the world of arts. On this inaugural show, I'll be joined by two of our regular voices on the programme, the film critic Jason Solomons and the arts and entertainment writer for the Daily Telegraph, Alice Vincent. We'll be talking Oscars, cinema screenings and music releases, plus we'll head to Rio for this year's Carnival celebrations. We'll find out what one member of staff has been listening to this week. And our very own Fernanda Augusto Pacheco will join us at the studio at the end of the show for his global music countdown. That's all coming up on this edition of the Monocle Arts Review with me, Robert Bound. Here we go then. Without further ado, Jason and Alice, welcome to the programme. Thanks for coming in.
Very nice to be here at the unveiling of a new masterpiece.
We're all terribly excited.
Don't be nasty. It's going to be fine.
I'm really
excited.
It's
going to be okay. We are going. I'm just pleased that you guys are here to to be on the ship, not as it sinks, to be on the ship as we swing the champagne bottle against its bows.
There we go. The launch. Brilliant.
Yeah, exactly. So let's take the bull by the horns. The elephant in the room, I suppose, in entertainment terms this week was the Oscars. We're still in the same week, so we're kind of fresh from them, I suppose. Fresh enough to be able to talk about them. Did the right people win, Jason?
Yeah, eventually, yes,
okay.
They did.
After a fashion.
Yeah, they did. I mean, I love Moonlight. I think I've talked on the station about it before how much I love it. But I also love La La Land. I have to stress that I wasn't part of the backlash from La La Land. I've loved La La Land since I first saw it at the Venice Film Festival. So I would have been delighted for La La Land to win, but it won 6 Oscars anyway, and so that's a decent haul. When I first saw Moonlight, I was worried it didn't quite have the robustness necessary to withstand award season. And funnily enough, in the end, it was La La Land that didn't quite have the robustness to withstand it. Look, Moonlight ran a subtler campaign, and I hate to reduce these things to kind of politics, but
well,
I think
interesting.
They are.
I mean, as a pro, this is very interesting that you're leading us through it in this way, in the behind the scenes way, rather than simply this film is better than that.
Well,
film,
because
this,
I mean, they're both. That. Do you know what? They're both brilliant. There's a wonderful, as we speak in the Reflect, there's a wonderful front cover of Variety today in the US with Damien Chazelle and Barry Jenkins coming out of the Chateau Marmont, both clutching an Oscar, both in that dishevelled morning after kind of way. I mean, I wish I'd had an all nighter like that. And it's a real kind of took me back to the, and they're kind of real like, oh, you're my best mate kind of stuff, you know. They really
also have the ends by then, right?
Well, totally. And to me, it was, you know, it was one of the most beautiful and symbolic moments in Oscar history, that you had this all white cast. And La La Land, I think, kind of lost because people said it was too white and too whiny, and people said, well, maybe it is. And then you had all this all black cast coming up, and this kind of sea of white and black mingling and hugging and handing over the baton. And you know, if you've been looking at Oscars so white, suddenly it was like Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream, but one day, you know, white people and black people will mix on the stage of the Dolby Theatre. And here they were doing it. And I sort of think they're both winners, because the graciousness with which Jordan Horowitz handed over and said, look, you've won, Moonlight has won. And I think, as Emma Stone said in a speech, they all know that Moonlight is an out-of-this-world thing to be winning an Oscar. I mean, I don't know another film that's as low budget as that, that's as experimental and poetic as that, as un-American as that. And I don't mean that in a kind of, you know, un-American
unusual
activity.
I suppose.
It's more like Wong Kar-wai, or Lynn Ramsey. It's not like a Hollywood movie. And I looked in the back in the annals. Annals?
We'll call them annals.
We'll call them annals.
It's a family show.
Where's the lifeboat?
This Moonlight is kind of it's affected me. I've seen the annals and thought, well, where's a similar Oscar winner, Best Picture winner? And 1969, Midnight Cowboy, similarly kind of, you know, homosexual themes going on, and also riding a new wave of kind of new wave European cinema by John Schlesinger. So that was the last time I could see it. Well, that's a long, long time ago, nearly sort of 48 years ago, the last time a film from so left field has won a Best Picture Oscar. I mean, you know, the old King's Speech, even 12 Years a Slave, which was sort of fresh in a way, but still was speaking in mainstream cinema. Moonlight's something totally new. So much as I love new La La Land, which was refreshing for the musical, Moonlight is just sort of a film from another planet. And if that's the way that movies are going, especially mainstream Hollywood movies, then actually everyone's a winner.
Well, it's incredible stuff. I mean, eventually the right movies won. The best performances won. Alice and Jason were saying, oh, I wish I'd had an all-nighter like that. I mean, A, we want to hang out with those people. We want to be at the Chateau Marmont with a bottle of Bollinger under our arm at 6 a.m. trying to get into our Uber or limo is nothing sacred.
Or our suite. We don't need an Uber.
Yes,
we live
exactly.
in there.
How did you watch it? Is it a Sky Plus event for you? Would you stay up all night? Because a lot of people, for many people that work in and around entertainment, it is a sacrament.
For me, it's an alarm goes off at 5 a.m, bleary-eyed, get into the office, deal with the aftermath. And I woke up and I was kind of scrolling through my phone, and it was very difficult. That it must have been happening just as the confusion was happening on stage, because it was very,
five.
Very difficult to work out who had actually won. And it was just emerging, oh my goodness, Moonlight won. And I thought that was completely surprising. I love that film. I enjoyed La La Land. I was completely blown away and touched by Moonlight. So I was very glad that it won, and I was astonished. But in many ways, that happening in the final moments eclipsed so much of the Oscars, to the extent that you kind of have to think, oh God, yeah, who else did pick up awards? And I think, you know, if that hadn't happened, everyone would be saying, isn't it a crying shame that Natalie Portman got overlooked for Jackie? People would be saying more about the Casey Affleck controversies. There were a lot of interesting stories going on that night, and they were completely blown out of the water by the biggest Oscars gaffe in history.
Yeah, and it is a gaffe, and everyone's gone a bit crazy about it. And it is a big gaffe, and it's great that a bloke called Brian, who's an accountant, kind of mucked it all up. They always say the accountants run Hollywood, where
he's
muck
both
it
Brian
up.
And a very naughty boy.
Isn't he, just?
For once.
I feel so sorry for Brian. I mean, everyone must have been having a terrible morning on Monday, but no one is having as bad a day as Brian.
He's called Brian, and he's had that day.
He
Poor
is,
boy.
It's all gone wrong for Brian.
We shall neatly seg then into some of your film reviews. You've got picked two things for this week, Jason. You're going to kick us off. Maybe we'll hear the trailer first. This is Trespass Against Us. It's a new movie starring Michael Fassbender and Brendan Gleeson.
It's going to start raining down on all of us. And they will break you on your own, you know that. But not if we stay tight.
Do what they say, kids.
This is your fault, you know that.
I love you so much.
I'm getting away from you, Colin.
You forget who you are, boy.
I'm just trying to look after my family.
I'm your family.
And there we are. That was the trailer for Trespass Against Us, out today. Starring Michael Fassbender and Brendan Gleeson. It sounds like The Detectorists on acid.
God, God knows what that sounds like, to be honest. It's just not really a flavour. Chemical Brothers, that music.
Is it really?
Yeah, it's their first, okay. It was not their first film score. But Adam Smith, who directs the film, has worked with the Chemicals for many years, done their visuals, and this is his first kind of major movie. He did a Chemicals concert movie in Japan a couple of years ago. And so he got them to do the score, which is a bit odd because it's a film about the traveller community.
These are Irish travellers in Devon.
They are. I mean, they're only Irish because they're played by Michael Fassbender and Brendan Gleeson, but they're
got
not
no accents
really,
there.
No, they've got
West
more
Country
a
accent.
West Country accent, even though I think it's set in Norfolk. Well, they're travellers, so they roam widely over a number of areas. So this is the accents do too. I mean, but it's full of very, very beautifully kind of nuanced dialogue where they and traveller slangs like gavers, which are policemen, you've got potentials and trouble. It's very Skrilla, which
strange,
is cash.
Strange plurals.
Exactly. And have an amaretto. My favourite line is have an amaretto. Come in. Brendan Gleeson's got these enormous hands. He plays the kind of father of the clan, if you like. I'm going to get some of the terminology wrong, so forgive me. And he's the kind of big centurion father, and he kind of rules this kind of criminal underworld with a kind of, well, not iron fish, these pudgy, fleshy fists.
Yeah.
I mean, they are the biggest hands. I mean, biggest hands in cinema. Like the goalkeeper, Pat Jennings, used to be. They're that sort of hands. And then his son is played by Michael Fassbender, who's trying to make good for his children and have a family. And he sort of says, I want them to go to do homework and stuff. And his dad says, you never did homework. And he goes, because you never sent me to school. That's why. So it's very much about being an outsider. But it's also about the kind of difficulties of breaking out of that kind of criminal life and that. So it paints a kind of picture of this, you know, it's reminds me slightly of Mark Rylance in Jerusalem.
Yeah.
Except this guy's really not, there's no redeeming features, and they're very selfish, led by Brendan Gleeson. And Michael Fassbender, who your heart goes out to, wants to break out of this. And then there's some really great chases through council estates and through country estates. I thought we'll see what they've done there. Yeah. There's a great bit where the helicopters, we heard it in the trailer, they're kind of looking for him, and he hides under a cow. And it's sort of a bit like, you know, Panto, where he's kind of walking underneath this cow to hide. And it's almost a bit silly, but Adam Smith really manages to work the kind of open spaces of Norfolk into thrilling chase scenes. It's slightly confused as a debut, but as a debut picture, I found it very sort of thrilling and great performances. You can't take your eyes off
Brendan Gleeson and Michael Fassbender, you'd watch them do the washing up, wouldn't you? Kind of thing. The two of those kind of actors, I guess.
Yeah.
It's kind of an interesting one. It kind of, the trailer kind of reminded me, it had bits of kind of Ben Wheatley movies. It seemed very kind of, it seemed spry, slightly ironic, very British somehow.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose a bit of sightseers because of the track, the caravan part, but there's also that kind of real, there's a bit of social realist grit in there as well. Definitely, you've got, you know, burning rubbish, you've got the kind of the chases, you've got the anti-cops. Rory Kinnear plays the sort of cop who's a bit sort of hapless and a bit given the runaround by Fassbender, who's a brilliant driver, of course, in his cars. So there's a real kind of abandon and lawlessness to it. It's kind of quite unique, and it's always interesting after the Oscars what distributors choose to put out, because it can be a bit of a lull. And this is obviously sort of a big name British movie, but it is a debut, and it's a strange piece. I've never really seen anything like it set in that community. It's written by Alistair Siddon, who did a documentary on a traveller family about 10 years ago, and has always wanted to kind of put them in a movie. And I don't know, some people will think it's exploiting that kind of, that, you know, in the way that my big fat gypsy weddings were exploitative in a way, and yet they're also revelatory and take you into communities you've never seen before. And I think that's what British cinema should be doing.
I think I'm kind of, I don't know about you, Alice, I'm quite well disposed to slightly uneven debut movies. I like things that are a bit sort of, you know, that you can see a lot of ambition and they're a bit wonky, precisely, right?
Yeah, I think, I mean, that's what makes them lovable later on. And the same with, I think, with debuts of all across the arts. I think that too much of a polished first thing, you almost miss the glint of something which makes it unusual.
Yeah, and there's a temptation to throw everything in there. So, oh God, they might not let me make another movie, so I'll do some chases.
Everything I've ever thought of.
Yeah, exactly. This does have the always go-to guy for kind of that. He's, you know, like Ben Foster in America, like in Hell or High Water, which was nominated at the Oscars, you get the kind of jumpy go-to guy. We have our own in Sean Harris, this kind of really wiry actor who plays the complete nutcase in the kind of Traveller clan.
Everyone needs one.
And he kind of gives the whole film a kind of wobbly edge. He plays a character called Wurzel, I believe, which is exactly what you want.
It is precisely what you want. We're probably going to go into more controlled climbs. We're going to talk next, Jason, your second choice, Gurinder Chadha's Viceroy House, about the British exit from India, the foundation of India as a country, and Pakistan. No small subject.
It isn't, indeed. 1947 partition, as it was called. Not a subject I knew very much about, I must say, going into Gurinder Chadha's film. And Gurinder, you know, of course, Benda Light Beckham, and she's translated that into a huge hit stage show. But her films of late, love her though I do, are uneven, to say the best about them. You know, they're kind of slightly all over the shop, really, kind of comedy. We don't really know what she was going to come up with next. And then attempting this really is a kind of epic sort of cinema that, you know, the sort of...
this is Merchant Ivory territory.
You're looking at sort of Gandhi territory, David, Richard Attenborough, and a bit Downton as well, because what she's done, Viceroy's House, the titular house, is that of Earl Mountbatten, who becomes the last Viceroy of India and sent in basically to sort out this mess. He's only got a couple of months to kind of sort out partition, which is basically dividing up India into Muslim Pakistan and then the rest of the country. So you've got a bit of Gandhi in there, you've got a bit of Nehru in there, everyone's coming for summit meetings at the house, and meanwhile the house is kind of going about its business with these opulent banquets. Lord and Lady Mountbatten, lady played by, brilliantly, I must say, by Gillian Anderson.
Doing a good upper crust, slightly Germanic English accent.
Yeah, she's kind of waddling a lot.
Lots of A's at her ease and all the rest of it.
She's absolutely, I mean, she's kind of frightening, but also brilliant as well. Apparently, the real Lady Mountbatten also had an affair with Nero, which has been put on a stage before. That's not in this film. That doesn't happen in this film because so much else is going on. I think we're in just...
There is a lot to pack into the film. Let's give our listeners a taste with the trailer, and then we'll see whether also Hugh Bonneville as Lord Mountbatten has escaped Downton Abbey.
300 million Hindus and Sikhs want a united India. 100 million Muslims do not.
You dance with your own kind.
My own kind?
Have some respect.
New nations are rarely born in peace.
It's got to be a clean cut.
It's a bloody axe cleaving right through people's lives.
Okay, a clip there from Gurinder Chadha's new movie called Viceroy House, about no small thing, the partition of... The 1947 partition and Indian...
I mean, what she does really well, Gurinder, is always seek out the kind of human in these kind of big drama stories. So what you get here is how that affects people, and to the point where you get, you know, cutlery being separated, going, oh, we'll have the forks, you have the knives. The splitting up becomes almost absurdist. But in Her Hands, that works very well, particularly the Downton aspect, the upstairs bit of the kind of posh English people. It's interesting how directors like Gurinder Chadha, like Amar Asante, are very good at presenting England in all its kind of pomposity rather than its pomp. It looks splendid, but there's always an undercurrent of we're viewing this as kind of ex-colonials and making you laugh at how ridiculous England was. Then the undercurrent is a love story between a Hindu and a Muslim, a man and a woman that have to find themselves in refugee camps, which I thought would be the sort of bit that Gurinder handles best. Actually, it's the other way around. She's really good at the Pink Gin's world. Okay. That's great. The rest of it is actually little. It doesn't quite work. I think the casting's wrong. The two Indian leads are sort of unspectacular, and the sort of attempts to kind of throw a bit of Bollywood cinema in there and a bit of dancing doesn't quite for me work. And it felt a bit schematic in a way. It was like, oh, I need if I can have a Hindu and a Muslim separated by love, this story going on. It took away from what was a really, really good job of explaining fiendishly complicated politics to an idiot like me. And she explained them very well and made them very dramatic.
And does it pull on the heartstrings? I think the score is great. A.R. Rahman again. That's good stuff. Does it pull on the heartstrings? Does it work? Are you sad about anything? Is there peril in the relationship? Peril as the British leave India?
I'm neither a Hindu nor a Muslim. And so I don't. Families are riven by this decision. It's not a politics that I know about. So I was fascinated to see how it happened. It seemed to be inevitable. It's presented quite well by Gurinder as an inevitable kind of consequence of the infighting that was going on. It was almost, and Hugh Bonneville's very good at kind of going, well, I'll just sort of, well, you have this bit and you'll have that bit. And
so what's it then? How good is he? Yes, because he seems a bit like that. He seems a bit like I feel like he's going to stroke a dying dog at any point. rather than, I can't imagine him as Mountbatten, a kind of a much spikier man in real life than he seems to be.
Yeah, the realpolitik of it becomes a little bit bumbled, if you like. Yeah. Maybe that's the point. And what I must say is that do stay around for the final credits, because Gurinder brings it back to a kind of heart-wrenching consequence of today and brings it back to what partition has meant today. And I know she was very keen to sort of say, well, the divide and rule is very much where we are now. This is what happens if you divide people along lines, you know. So whether partition is an enduring scar, whether India's got on with it, I'm not sure from this movie where her sympathies lie. All I know is that if you do this in a country one night, you just cleft it in half, then tragedy will ensue. That's without a doubt.
Well, thank you for walking us through that one eloquently, elegantly, tiptoeing, dancing between the raindrops. It's a tough thing even to talk about, I suppose, and Gurinder Chadha has done her very best. Jason, thank you very much for your two film choices. Trespass Against Us and Viceroy's House are both out in cinemas today, in fact. And now, before we get into Alice's music picks of the week, we're going to debut a new feature on the show where we hear from a member of the Monocle staff about what they've been listening to, watching, reading, or have been inspired by this week. And this week, it is the turn of our Toronto Bureau Chief, Thomas Lewis. He said Johnny Cash's 1970 hit Sunday Morning Coming Down, he drinks too much, which was originally written by Kris Kristofferson, stuck in his head all week, and here he is to tell us why.
Well, I woke up Sunday morning with no way to hold my head. That didn't hurt.
I was in New York City and I'd been having brunch with a friend, and I'd gone to the bathroom. I was washing my hands and there was this song playing in the background, and the lyrics just caught my ear. And I just stood there listening to the rest of this song, trying to figure out what the song was called from like the sort of the anchor lyrics. And I heard it, Sunday Morning Coming Down, and searched it and have been listening to it pretty much non-stop.
Then I washed my face and combed my hair and stumbled down the stairs to meet the day.
The extraordinary thing about the song for me is that the melody is so jaunty, it's so cheerful, and it's so relentless that the tempo doesn't change at all, and it's very instrumental. You've got the piano, the different guitars, the percussionist, and it's really upbeat. But Kris Kristofferson's words are really sad. They're semi-autobiographical, I think. He wrote this when he was living in Nashville, Tennessee, when he was trying to break into the music industry. Now, he had been to Oxford University. He had been a pretty senior figure in the US Army. He'd been invited to go and teach at the US Military Academy, but he gave all that up to go and be a janitor at a record label in Nashville. And he and Johnny Cash have told this story several times, but the sort of the lower rung staff at the record label were told, apparently, that they were never allowed to approach the artists coming and going. Now, that's a rule that Kris Kristofferson broke, and he'd go up to Johnny Cash and basically pitch every new song that he'd written in the hope that someone would listen.
That makes a body feel alone.
This song basically tells the story of a Sunday morning after quite a wild Saturday night the night before. It starts, "I woke up Sunday morning with no way to hold my head that didn't hurt." And it just goes on about the singer, the voice of the narrator of the song, if you like, stumbling out into the day and wandering along a sidewalk that's pretty empty. And all it is really is a collection of observations of the sound of children singing hymns in a Sunday school, of a father swinging his daughter who's laughing on a swing in a park nearby. And all of these anecdotes basically compound the idea, I think, that the narrator of the song is totally alone and has had a wild night the night before, but come Sunday, he feels as though he's totally detached from the world that he's seeing and experiencing.
And it echoed through the canyons like a disappearing dreams of yesterday.
It's quite a strange thing, isn't it, I suppose, when you become slightly addicted to a song that is ultimately really pretty sad. And I think it's this mix of the bitter and the sweet, I suppose, of this song that I just find I just can't get out of my head. I just have to keep listening to it. And I don't know whether it's still trying to make sense of how those two things sort of sit together, you know, in life, in art, those kind of things. And whether it's a kind of, you know, trying to figure out in one's own experience, you know, how those things do sort of coexist, you know, as, you know, sidewalks lie empty, as sidewalks kind of fill up, as, you know, people live their lives around you when you're trying to make sense of your own.
And Sunday morning coming down.
That was Monocle's Thomas Lewis there on Johnny Cash's Sunday Morning Coming Down. Alice Vincent, here we are. We're back. And you're going to talk us through your music choices for the week. Two things that I found to be interesting earworms. Nice stuff to research this. You're going to tell us first about Thundercat. Good name.
Great name.
Now, he's one of these kind of uber collaborators, Kendrick Lamar. And no one is safe from a collaboration
Thundercat
with Thundercat,
gets
right?
Everywhere. The thing is with Thundercat, for the uninitiated into the cat world, he's essentially a bassist who can sing utterly beautifully. So he's based in LA. He's famous for kind of working with Flying Lotus.
Yeah.
But yeah, as you say, he's worked with pretty much everyone. And he has brought, this is his third album. It's called Drunk. And it shows a kind of progression. The last couple of albums, one of his close collaborators died a few years ago. And they were very much kind of, they were existential, mournful, contemplative things. And it's almost like he's shaking off that misery a little bit. And Drunk is about getting through life with alcohol or otherwise. I mean, that sounds a bit
power
dismissive, but it's very good.
it's all right. I think we our listeners deserve a taste of this stuff.
The booze or the Thundercat?
Well, we can kind of chink glasses. We'll see if we've only got any of that champagne left. Let's have a cut of this. This is Thundercat with Show You The Way, featuring Michael McDonald and Kenny Loggins, no less. Okay, nice. And a little bit of voiceover there. And it's Kenny Loggins.
Yeah.
And he kind of brings people in, like Mike Oldfield would have done with various instruments.
Yacht rock.
It's really good.
Mm.
Yeah, it's a bit of yacht rock there. Mm. Jason Solomon's loving just the name Kenny Loggins. Goes crazy.
Just made me, I'm footloose now.
Yeah, right. Yeah. It sounds great, doesn't it? And
yeah.
I mean, how much of this is just, there's a lot of retro on this. There's a lot of fly soul and all that kind of stuff.
There is a lot of that, but then there's also a lot of like, late 80s, early 90s Nintendo video game 8-bit noise, okay, and him serenading his cat and a bit of Black Lives Matter and a bit of him escaping to Tokyo. Like this, it's 23 songs long, this album. It's a biggie. And you just sort of want to put it on, soak it in. I mean, it's a record I've been listening to for a week because it's been out. But I hope that it's one that is going to span 2017, like something I'm going to pick in and out of for the rest of the year.
Yeah, it seems to me one of those things that it's 27 tracks long. It's not, there's interludes, there's bits and bobs, there's 30-second tracks, there's all this kind of stuff going on in it. It's not a triple album or something. It's not a prog rock monster, is it? It's something very different to that. But it seems something that you need to kind of work out in your head a little bit.
What's the genre? Right? Where do you put it?
Jazz.
It is jazz. So actually,
do you put it in jazz? Are you saying it's jazz?
In the Kamasi Washington, Kendrick Lamar jazz way.
Yeah, exactly. You've got it in one. Yeah, I'd always... In my mind, Thundercat is always jazz.
Yeah.
And it's interesting, very briefly going back to La La Land, which, from a musical perspective, opened up so many conversations about jazz and where jazz is going and the problems of Ryan Gosling's notion of jazz and LA jazz.
Yeah.
Well, to me, LA jazz is Thundercat.
Yeah,
and
it
this
is
what it sounds like.
And you have
like.
To magpie, because that's what jazz does, which is slightly disappointing in that Ryan only wanted to kind of, you know,
his character.
Quartets.
Yeah. Yes, it was grossly disappointing, yeah.
Because yes,
you wanted
just
some Kamasi Washington in it, didn't you? Right?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. That's samba and tapas. Choose one.
Do you want to, should we write the sequel around this very table?
Let's get it down.
I also like the notion of Jason walking around befuddled in Amoeba Records in LA, scratching his head, going, well, where is it?
get
where on this
right.
new album, Alice?
Is that Thundercat with a K?
Where's the drunk?
And it's a good name for a record. It's got a wonderful, this is something worth buying on vinyl for the size of the album cover alone. Great, with him kind of submerged reddened eyes.
It looks
weird, doesn't it? It looks like a sort of blaxploitation album cover, doesn't it, from the 70s or something.
It's odd thing. There's definitely a lot of retro overtones in it. But what I like about it is that it is, as ever with Thundercat, it is propelling the notion of his genre and jazz totally forward. And I feel that in 5 years' time, there will be records that, you know, link back to this.
Yeah. Yeah, it can't keep still. That's what's lovely about this record. I think you're right. I think it's something that will age like a vintage wine because it's got so much going on in it. You can't
nice
quite...
pension for Michael McDonald and Kenny Loggins and other washed-up 80s vocalists.
Yeah, right?
Yeah, it's good for them.
Yeah, it is good for
keeps
them.
Keep something to do.
Keep something to do, yeah.
More practical advice there from Jason Solomons. so that is Thundercat. The album is called Drunk, as recommended by Alice Vincent. Alice, why don't we take a slice, actually? Your next choice is Jens Lekman. This is called Hotwire, the Ferris wheel. Lately you've been around. Life called it one of the streams back. I'm here if you want to chat. Just keep my mouth shut if you prefer that. Okay, a taster from Jens Lekman's new album. That's called How to Hotwire the Ferris Wheel. Life Will See You Now is the name of the LP. This is lovely stuff. Jason's wandering around in Amoeba Records in LA again. Where do you send him for Jens Lekman?
Well, traditionally for Jens Lekman, I'd send him to the winsome, Scandi, sad...
Yeah.
Navel gazing section.
In the right-hand corner, yeah.
That's in the basement.
Exactly where it is.
But Jens has had a little... He's changed neighbourhood lately. He's gone firmly into the pop section.
Yeah.
Scandi pop.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm really glad you picked that track to play because I love it shamelessly, even though it reminds me quite a lot of Simply Red.
Yeah.
And also a little bit Baby Bird. You know, You're Gorgeous.
Yes. Mm.
Like it's very early 90s pop cheesiness about it. And I love it. And Tracy Thorn, who is also...
I was going to say, it sounds a little bit Everything But The Girl.
She features on that song towards the end.
Okay.
And it's got that kind of nice turn of the 90s feel about it.
I really like it. Mm. It's good stuff. There is something of... I think M People could also possibly
yes,
be
M
providing
People,
the
Lighthouse
backing
family.
Track for that. Right?
Let's get a Spotify playlist.
Yeah,
together.
Let's do it. Let's do it. What happens, Alice, when an artist jumps across stream mid-river and goes from a kind of a bit of a Scandi noir artist to a winsome or
Scandi pop.
So a Scandi pop. What happens?
Well, he had for the first time, Lekman worked with a producer on this record.
Right.
This is his fourth album.
Someone's reined him in a bit.
Well, I think they've said, try some samba, Jens. Live a little.
Yeah.
Which is pretty much what's happened. And it's not just samba, there's kind of weird, like, A little bit of calypso on there. I mean, really weird genres. And there's not, there's no like big disco beats or anything like that. It's not kind of your Robin style Scandi pop or anything like that. Or God, Steve Aoki. You know, none of that stuff going on. But it is genuinely lovely. And actually, what I have seen coming as a general trend is the return of indie pop, which was very big in the late noughties. Things like MGMT, Vampire Weekend, Dirty Projectors, and that kind of faded away with this alt R&B thing that's been happening for a few years. And there's been a lot of artists coming out over the last few months with some really nice indie pop, and I'm glad to see it back. It's kind of it's like a little a fuzzy, slightly too small jumper. It makes
you,
me comfy.
Would you know it was Scandi in the way that it you know in the way that it captures the kind of environment of Scandinavia, you know, like the Icelandic kind of stuff does. Can you tell it?
No, I mean the thing is, this isn't your classic kind of what I would think of as your classic shiny Scandi pop, like everything from ABBA to Robin.
Yeah.
But it does have the tears on the dance floor element, which I feel is elemental to all Scandinavian pop. Like, there is a lot of heartbreak in this album and also a lot of introspective sort of, you know, oh, I'm having a crisis, sort of, I'm not good enough. You know, the kind of the creative flux, which everyone struggles with, I think, if you're trying to make something.
Well, it's called Life Will See You Now.
Exactly.
So he's obviously, maybe he was staring at the ceiling on his analyst's couch.
Yeah.
Analysts, as Joseph would say. So maybe an album not wrought without worry. Let's not try and laugh our way through the next link. Alice, thank you so much for talking us through Life Will See You Now by Jens Lekman and, of course, Drunk by Thundercat. They're both out now. It's all right. It's fine. We'll just cough, clear our throats, and we're going to move on. Now, this past week, carnival festivities are wrapped up around the world, and there's no place the party is bigger, of course, than in Rio de Janeiro. Annual carnival festivities attract millions of visitors every year from around the world, and at the centre of it is the Samba School Parade at the city's Sambadrome. Over several days, Rio's Samba Schools compete for the coveted title, but in order to get the choreography and the costumes right, it takes months of practice. And that is exactly what our Rio correspondent did. Sheena Roster has spent the past several months training with Samba School Unidos de Tijuca, and she tells us what it's like to take part in the city's massive annual carnival parade, even when it doesn't quite go to plan.
I've been in Brazil for 6 years and seven carnivals, and by far, carnival is definitely my favorite time of the year. And as carnival came and went every year, I would see those bright lights and flashy costumes on TV, wishing I committed to be part of the parade too. So this year, I took the plunge and I joined Unidos da Tijuca Samba School. Every year, each of the 12 First Division Samba schools have their own theme, which needs to be clearly told through the school's floats and sections. Ours this year is American popular culture. Starting with the American Revolution, working our way down through the New Orleans jazz scene and country and rock music, we take a trip through Broadway and finish on the float that I'm part of, pop and hip-hop music. My character, a b-boy, as we pay homage to Snoop Dogg.
Eu tenho 12 anos de Unidos da Tijuca.
On the top of my float, playing the character of American jazz great Louis Armstrong, is Alexandre Monteiro dos Santos. He's been a loyal member of Unidos da Tijuca for the past 12 years. He tells me that he's been awarded this character after years of loyalty to the school, never missing a practice and always participating. He tells me that he can't wait to take part in the parade. He's been watching YouTube videos studying Louis Armstrong's moves in order to get into character for the day of the parade. It's been a lot of work in the lead up to the parade. Every Monday, we've been practicing on or around the floats at Cidade do Samba, Samba City, where all the floats for each school are built, housed, and stored in the lead up to the parade. These practices could take as little as 4 hours or could go as long as seven. Then on Thursdays, every section from the school would meet in the north zone of Rio, close to the city's bus terminal, to walk down the street to practice as if we were walking down the Marquês de Sapucaí on the big day. And all this rehearsal for several months has come down to one day. Our hour and 15 minutes in the Marquez de Sapucaí on Carnival Monday for our parade. The buzz in the air here is truly electric as we all gather before our big moment. We turn the corner, inching towards the start line, and we get some words of encouragement from the school's directors. This is my first time with the school, but for some people on my float, like Michael Ribeiro, he is a repeat performer with the school. He's on the side of my float, playing the part of the village people.
I've been introduced here to Tijuca, and then for the time being, I've always been here doing the parade, so I love it, love it. From the bottom of my heart.
Thunderous sounds of fireworks rip through the air to announce the start of each samba school, and we're off. Admittedly, the parade didn't start well. Shortly after Unidos da Tijuca started out, part of the structure on her second of six floats collapsed, injuring 12 people. It was the worst accident during the carnival parade at the Marquez de Sapucaí that any samba school had suffered in the Avenida's 33 years of existence. But thankfully, no one was seriously injured. And after a 25-minute delay, the school's directors decided that the show must go on. But then, disaster struck again. On our third float, which represented country music, the engine stalled, and the float wouldn't move, forcing other sections to move ahead of it, leaving our storyline to break with the continuity. Eventually, the country theme float got going, but we were seriously up against the clock. The well-rehearsed choreography quickly went out the window as the float accelerated and we had to scurry alongside it. And as soon as we knew it, the parade was over. And with all its flaws, it certainly wasn't a winning performance. In fact, we got 11th place, second last in the first division. But despite all the hiccups and problems we had during our parade, putting on the show is no easy feat. For many people that are in my samba school, the parade is a full-time career. Just to put on our parade cost around 14 million reais. That's about 4.5 million US dollars, and they work on this production year-round. Production logistics aside, though, being part of Unidos da Tijuca was a unique and special experience where memories were formed and new friends were made. And samba schools like this one, in a way, act as a glue that bring together the cross-sections of society in an otherwise divided city, even if it's just for carnival. For Monocle, in Rio de Janeiro, I'm Sheena Rossiter.
Thank you, Sheena. And to end the show, we've brought a dose of Brazil into the studio in the form of Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Welcome.
Hello, Rob.
Now, you're going to be joining us every week. This is a new thing, isn't it? You're going to join us every week to talk us through what's number one, or the charts generally, in a particular territory, in a particular part of the world. What is your first choice?
I was going to choose Brazil, actually, first, but then I said, you know what? I'm going to follow my heart. And yeah. I chose Sweden because, okay. As you know, I do love Swedish pop music. I think it's one of the most relevant charts in the world because a song that is number one now in Sweden, in a few weeks' time, will be in the UK or in the US. I mean, of course, not every week. So it's like a
lab for the rest of the world's pop.
Absolutely, okay. Absolutely. And as you were talking before, you know, the Swedes, they have a penchant for a very good melody as well.
Yeah.
And it's interesting what you said. I mean, I did look at the full chart. There's not many songs like in Swedish, you know. Most of the Swedish artists, they do sing in English. Mm. An exception here or so, but you know, most of them in English.
Okay, and what's your top pick? Are we running down from 5 to 1, or are we going straight for it?
A little countdown.
Let's roll it.
We do like a good countdown, no? So number 5, we have Zayn and Taylor Swift with I Don't Wanna Live Forever, which is the soundtrack of 50 Shades Darker. It's interesting because, you know, even though the film, you know, all the critics hate it, I'm not sure what you think about it, Alice and Jason, but
the soundtrack was better than the film.
Exactly.
It was. Yeah.
That's always the case. And the song is climbing up the charts in the US as well. I think it's actually...
The film did is the fifth highest grossing 18 certificate in British UK cinema history. So, you know, there's no accounting for taste.
Exactly. And it's a good song, actually. I Don't Want to Live Forever. But number four, a little bit of an Euro touch with the young Dutch DJ Martin Garrix. He's only 20. That's crazy. With Dua Lipa, which is a British singer. And they have a track, Scared to Be Lonely. And it's interesting, Rob, the tropical house beats, I mean, it's dominating the charts so much. Number four to number one, they all have the tropical house beat, except number five with Zayn. So that's quite interesting to notice as
well. I can understand that. I mean, February in Stockholm, I want some tropical house in my life, don't you?
It's been kicking around for a long, long time. In fact, it's funny, before the show, Jason and I were talking about Sean Paul. And, I could talk about Sean Paul and tropical house, a.k.a. the whitewashing of dance hallers. Long as the day is long. But, Fernando, back to you.
Which it isn't in Sweden at this time of year.
Yeah.
Well, number three, you have the Norwegian DJ Kygo, which is also, I mean, he was also one of the first as well to use this tropical house beat as well. And I think the beats he used, you know, is being used for other DJs as well. But this time has a new track with Selena Gomez, It Ain't Me. And I have to say, I'm quite a big fan, actually, of Selena Gomez. Her latest album, I think, was full of amazing pop tracks. What did you think
of
it?
This is such a good track. Yeah. Like, it's one of those, it's a proper earwormer. But before you can even say that's so annoying, you're just like, I need more of it. Give me more. It's such a good track. I love it.
It is very addictive. Shame is not number one, otherwise we would play a clip as well.
Yeah, damn it. So maybe we can engineer it into next week's show in some way, Faye. Maybe it's number three in Ireland or whatever you're going to choose next. However, this is a lot of producers featuring vocalists, right? This is where we go. This is massive in the Swedish charts.
Absolutely.
Presumably rarer there than, for example, in the UK charts, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And they do love electronic music in Sweden. You know, of course the UK does as well, but I think Sweden much more. If you look at the top 20, I would say like 15 of them, a kind of electronic music, similar style from the ones I've been mentioning. And number two is someone that, to be honest with you, I had a certain prejudice against him, but I did listen to the track again, and he's all right. It's Ed Sheeran, Shape of You.
The biggest male pop star on the planet, says GQ.
Yes, I mean, kudos for him. I mean, it's a good track, you know, his best one, actually, for me. And there's actually a little bit of a, you know, tropical beat vibe to it.
I think 2017 is going to be to Ed Sheeran what 2015 was to Justin Bieber, in that suddenly, you know, he's like Stormzy, a lot of grime collaborators have come out and given him the thumbs up. He's on Noisy, which is a very cool like music channel at the moment. You wait, you're going to be loving Ed Sheeran by the end of the year, whether you like it or not.
He won a Mobo a few years ago, didn't he? And didn't he win the most influential artist on One Extra? That was quite controversial.
Stormzy or Ed Sheeran?
No,
Ed Sheeran. He's actually got grime roots. Yeah. So, like, weirdly, but he has.
But shall we listen to it?
I'm literally Googling that as we speak. So, and what's number one?
I'm not going to mention. I think we should hear a clip and then we'll discuss it later.
Beautiful. Hit it, Faye. What did we just hear?
So that was Joakim Lundell featuring Arhout with All I Need. Again, another
DJ. In a
very
EDM place there, aren't we? They were very kind of...
But he has a very interesting backstory. I was looking. I mean, he's not just another DJ. Basically, he became successful in Sweden in a reality show in 2000 called The Kings of Tylösand, which was a bunch of young people going to the surf town in Sweden. It was like the Swedish Jersey Shore. And after that, he became super famous on YouTube. I believe he's got like almost 600,000 YouTube like. You know, people like on his account. So, he became huge in Sweden. And I believe this is just his second or third single. And he got the young singer Arhout, also from Sweden, to perform this track with him.
Arhout sounds good, doesn't it? But it does sound, it sounds like a university town in Sweden.
Or it could be a new Scandinoir, like Nordic Arhout. Noir drama. Like he could be so many things.
It's a good track, you know, if you're on the dance floor. Again, there's nothing new about
it. Feels like
it
needs a remix to me for a proper dance floor get down, though.
Yeah.
I believe so as well. And I feel a bit sorry for Joakim because I was reading his latest news. He just came back from Egypt. He was on holiday with his girlfriend and somebody, damaged his car. And he said, I'll pay for those who did it. It's big news in Sweden at the moment.
That's, I love that.
I love that. That is big news.
Someone's bent the aerial of his Ford Fiesta.
Yeah.
Serious.
You know you can rub onto it. Someone's damaged your paintwork. Arhult is very good for that. It's a brand. I don't know if I mentioned brand names, but that's... Jason's laughing as if he's remembering a different joke. That brings us to the end of this edition of the Monocle Arts Review. Thank you so much to my guests, Alice Vincent and Jason Solomons. And the show is produced by Holly Fisher, researched by Fernando Ogasso Pacheco, whose voice you just heard as well, of course. Join us at the same time again next week. But for the time being, for the rest of the team, we're going to play out with Joachim Lundell and Arholt again. And thank you very much for tuning in.